Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And this is part two of
From the River to the Sea. Oh yes, Palestine will be free. Israeli defense forces colluding with settlers escalated their attacks against Palestinians from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem's Old City, killing dozens, including children, and wounding hundreds more. We're joined by Rashid Ismail Khalidi, a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East and Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University and director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and author of The 100 Years' War on Palestine. He'll discuss the violence in Jerusalem as Israeli police and Zionist settlers rain down death on protesters rallying against the forced expulsions of Palestinian families from the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the Israeli force raid on Al-Aqsa on one of the holiest nights of Ramadan as part of the 100 Years war on Palestine. Professor Khalidi, thank you for joining us. I want to return to the events on the ground. One of the things that we've spoken about before this conversation is the alliance, or perhaps the symbiosis is a better word, of the Israeli Defense Force, the Israeli government, with the new right-wing movements, settler movements. And I hope you can elaborate more, but I'm not sure we understand how fully weaved together the assaults that occurred, Sheikh Jarrah, were between the government forces and these settler groups.
This is not entirely new. Going right back to the arrival of Menachem Begin as prime minister in 1977, the Israeli government, and even before under labor governments, the Israeli government has always benefited from the actions of settlers. There were Israeli prime ministers like Rabin who were annoyed by the settlers. But certainly since 1977, since the election of Begin, And under successive succeeding Likud prime ministers, whether Shamir or Sharon or Netanyahu or Olmert, the settlers have always operated hand in glove with the Israeli government and security forces and legal system. The Supreme Court has almost invariably validated what they were trying to do. The military and the security forces have invariably supported the settlers or stood by while the settlers attacked Palestinians. Settlers are never, almost never tried and never convicted. Members of security forces are almost never tried and never convicted for the thousands and thousands of assaults on Palestinians that have taken place over the past 50-odd years. So there is a hand-in-glove relationship with the settlement movement, certainly under Likud governments, which have dominated Israel with a couple of exceptions since 1977. So we're talking 40-odd years.
One of the things I also want to raise up is the claims of the settlers, whether biblical and spiritual in nature, in a sense, or other justifications and debunking them for the confiscation of the land, the expulsion of people. Let's really parse that out and as I said, shred it for the fraud that it is, which is the claim to the homes, the land base, and indeed the history itself being cleansed from the land, the history of the Palestinian people.
Right. The settler movement represents the most extreme, the religious nationalist element of it in particular, represents the most extreme example of this. But I think this is integral to Zionism. If you go back and listen to the iconic song of the iconic movie based on the iconic book Exodus, "This land is our land. God gave this land to us." I don't know if anybody remembers that song from that awful movie, but that's not the settlers talking. That's a labor Zionist hero or represents a labor Zionist hero of the 1948 era in this movie and in this awful book by Leon Uris, Exodus. So that idea has been a through line of Zionism from the very beginning. There is one people in the land of Israel. It's the Jewish people. There's one people in that is entitled to self-determination. It's the Jewish people. And that has been enshrined in constitutional law of the state of Israel since 2018. The Jewish nation state law of 2018 basically says that. There is one people in the land of Israel, in Israel, with a right of self-determination. The Arabs are not a people that has a right of self-determination. And that is not religious Zionism speaking. That is the Knesset of the State of Israel, in a law that was passed with an overwhelming majority of all parties. So I think we see the extremists and should look at them carefully, and their extraordinary statements. The deputy mayor of Jerusalem has basically said this whole city belongs to us, and we're going to get these people out, or something to that effect. One of the deputy mayors of Jerusalem. The other had a much more sophisticated concern for public relations and said, no, we're not engaged in ethnic cleansing. The other guy said, yes, we are engaged in ethnic cleansing. This place is ours and it belongs to us, and only we have rights here, and anybody who doesn't like it can leave. And in fact, they are being forcing people to leave. We look at that extreme tendency and we miss the fact that across most of the political spectrum in Israel, the idea that there is only one people with rights in this country, or that one people has superior rights in this country, is a consensus. And that is central to Zionism. Even in the reporting of the New York Times, you've had a discussion of property issues that go right to the root of this. His name is Kingsley, Ben Kingsley, I think the New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem, has had in a couple of items reporting on the fact that there are claims being made to Jewish property rights in East Jerusalem, but that Arab claims to property rights in West Jerusalem that was taken over in 1948 are ignored by Israeli law. And under Israeli law, those claims cannot be respected. Whereas any claim by any Jewish property owner to property in occupied territories is scrupulously observed by the courts. And that goes back to the same kind of thing, a regime of one set of laws for one group and another set of laws for another group. And this operates inside Israel. We're not just talking in the occupied territories. So I think we're right to look at the most extreme expression of these views, but I think what's important to see is that some of these ideas are central to Zionism itself, that one people has exclusive rights or superior rights in this country. And if the other people exists, it has to be seen as subordinate. And its rights are to be only exercised at the expense of the rights of the other people.
So clearly the issues are playing themselves out with a land base and the cleansing of the land of the Palestinian people from that base and their historic property rights as well. But it's much deeper, and it's a philosophic and it's a political system that is creating these tensions and playing itself out in what would appear to be property issues. But you've made it quite clear that it's a much more profound reality with the establishment of the State of Israel. But, you know, I think it's time to begin to look at, principles for solution, as you might say, to ongoing, again, Nakba, as it's termed by the Palestinians, a catastrophe that ensued in the 1948 and has continued ever since and is right now in its state of terrifying escalation. And we should say that it looks like it's also extending certainly beyond Gaza and beyond the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. So if you could talk about that for a moment, and then let's turn our attention to, is it a one-state solution that we're talking about, and or are there other issues relevant to really looking at a solution for, if you will, equal rights and justice?
I think two things. I think that what we're seeing now is essentially a continuation of something that's been going on since the beginning of the Zionist project. This is not entirely new to create a Jewish state in a majority Arab country necessarily and inevitably involved the dispossession of as much as possible of that Arab majority. That's why the Nakba happened. It didn't happen because of specific incidents. It happened because of a logic, a political logic that was inherent to Zionism. To create a Jewish state in an Arab majority land, you have to dispossess that majority. You can't have it otherwise. It couldn't have happened otherwise. Early on, at the beginning of the British Mandate, some Zionist leaders believed that immigration protected by the British would inflate the Jewish population such that it would become a majority, and then they could simply claim right of self-determination as a Jewish majority. That didn't happen. So it became clear that the only way to achieve a Jewish state in an Arab majority land in 1948, when the Nakba happened, two-thirds of the population of Palestine was Arab. You could not have a Jewish state in most of Palestine or all of Palestine, which is what the Zionist movement wanted, without reducing that Arab population. And you couldn't, they were going to leave voluntarily and they wouldn't be bought out. So you had to force them out. That was absolutely, inevitably, necessarily part of Zionism. Once it was clear that a majority would not be achieved simply by immigration. And that process has continued to this day, whereby it is argued that in order to have a Jewish state, you have to have control of land, you have to have a demographic preponderance, and that necessitates actions against Arab rights, human rights, civil rights, religious rights, political rights, and property rights. And that's what we're seeing played out in Sheikh Jarrah. And that is not new. This is part of a process that's been going on for over 100 years, which is why I called my book The 100 Years War on Palestine. This is just the latest skirmish, if you will, in that war. Now, you mentioned a one-state or a two-state solution. I think before we have a discussion of a solution, I think it's necessary to be very clear-eyed about the status quo, the situation. Now, one state controls the entire land. Can you enter or exit? It's the Israeli government that decides that. Can you import or export? It's the Israeli government that decides that. Can you drill for water on your own property? It's the Israeli government that decides that. Can you fly over? Israel has absolute, complete, total, and exclusive sovereignty over the entirety of formerly mandatory Palestine, i.e. Israel and the occupied territory. So the question is, where do we go from this one-state reality? Do we go towards a two-state reality or a cantonal solution or a binational state or one state or a federation? I think we're so far from being able to change the status quo that what we have to do is talk about principles and talk about how we change the status quo rather than saying what I want is this or what I want is that. I think any of the solutions I've mentioned, one state, two states, binational, cantonal, federal, whatever, raises all kinds of problems. And I don't want to go into them, frankly, because I think we have to start from first principles. Are there two peoples there? Yes. Do they have rights, national and collective? Yes. It's not the same. There's one population that is a result of a settler colonial project, the Zionist project. But settler colonial projects have created national entities. We live in one, the United States. Canada is another. Australia is another. New Zealand is another. Like it or lump it, whether it is the result of a settler colonial project or not, there is an entity called the Israeli people. Is there another people? Absolutely. The indigenous population of the land that had an absolute right to self-determination under the League of Nations charter and covenant and mandate for Palestine and had an absolute right to self-determination under the United Nations Charter, but which has been systematically denied that right. Should there be equal rights for all citizens, whether of one group or the other? Yes, they should have equal political rights. They should have equal civil rights. They should have equal religious rights. They should have equal property rights, equal human rights. Do they have that now? No. How do you get to that? Well, there are many ways of trying to get to that. But I think those are the kinds of principles that we should be talking about. If one group of people can bring in their relatives, another group of people as citizens to live peacefully together or to live in separate states, then the other group should have that right. If one group claims property rights, the other group should be able to claim property rights, and so on and so forth. In other words, one of the issues at dispute in Sheikh Jarrah is a claim that there is some property there that was originally purchased by Jewish owners back in 1875. Whatever the chain of ownership between 1875 and 2021 is, we don't know. But the point is that claim is being made, whereas a claim to my grandfather's house in Jaffa, or a claim of people living in Sheikh Jarrah, refugees driven from Haifa in 1948, like the Kurd family, those claims are not allowed. Whereas other claims are not only allowed, but are enforced with bayonets and tear gas and beatings and people's furniture being thrown out of their homes. So I think you have to talk about a solution that involves absolutely equal rights for everybody. How that's to be done, I don't know. We're very far away from it, however. And I frankly think that talking about one state or two state right now is premature. How do you get away from this one state, this unequal, discriminatory, segregationist, murderous one state reality where one people absolutely dominates and imposes its will at the expense of the other? And I don't know how you do that, but I think those are the questions to ask.
How do you really assess the Palestinians' activity on the ground to that point of equal rights and justice? How do you look at the forces, the promise there?
Right.
And similarly, if you could take us through what you think the effects of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement are,
yeah,
on the international community, and what we hope is a growing support for Palestinian self-determination.
Let me start from the end point and then maybe go backwards. The Palestinians have had a very difficult time in terms of political leadership. And this is a particularly grim moment, I think. The physical divisions between the West Bank and Gaza, the fact that over half of the Palestinian population lives outside of historic Palestine, fact that over 1.5 million, close to 2 million Palestinians live as citizens of the State of Israel, means that the Palestinians are physically divided, and they're politically divided. And there's no unifying national movement, as there was for a number of decades under the PLO, that brings them together around a common strategy. And I think that that's something that's much needed, and I hope will come about in the near future. We're in a state of political paralysis, partly because there is no unified national movement and there's no clear strategy for the Palestinian people right now. And that's one reason we are where we are. Into that leadership vacuum have stepped, I think, a number of civil society actors. It is civil society that produced the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. It's civil society that's standing up to these attempts to take over property in Sheikh Jarrah and other parts of the occupied territories. The only place that you have any kind of organized, effective political leadership among Palestinians is inside Israel, where you have a number of Knesset members, where you have a coordinating committee for the Arab mayors. But with a few exceptions, it's essentially civil society that's doing the heavy lifting, and that's not sufficient. You really need a strategy. You need people who can effectively communicate to the world what the Palestinians want, why that is just, and how that can be achieved. And we don't have that right now. We have an ineffective gerontocracy headed by a man who should have left politics long ago in Ramallah, and we have a leadership in Gaza, controlling Gaza, which has no strategy for achieving any Palestinian national goal in Hamas. Both of them, I think, are bankrupt in terms of what they can offer to the Palestinian people. They've done less to advance the Palestinian cause than Palestinian civil society has, frankly, in the last couple of decades, since the Palestinian Authority was formed, since the split between Fatah and Hamas. Those leaderships have done absolutely nothing to advance the cause, and I think they've actually severely retarded the cause, frankly. Whereas one can see, in terms of the way in which debate has been widened in this country, the success of civil society initiatives, whether student groups, whether BDS, whether solidarity groups with the Palestinians, whether intersectional outreach to other groups, Native Americans, Black Americans, and so on and so forth. who can see some similarities in the injustices that have been inflicted upon them and the injustices that are being inflicted on the Palestinians. So I think that there has been progress in terms of discourse in the United States, considerable progress, but it's nothing. It's not to the credit in any way, manner, shape, or form of these leaderships who deserve only opprobrium for their complete failure to unify and to advance the Palestinian cause. And I can't wait for them to be superseded by a younger, more savvy generation.
And finally, is there a message as we are living and speaking in the midst of this most recent terrifying assault on the Palestinian people, for those who are listening to this program, as to what they need to do to support a free, free Palestine?
Well, you know, we're American citizens, and our government is responsible for much of what's happening. Without the United States running interference, systematically running interference against any attempts to sanction Israel for its actions globally, diplomatically, at the UN, Israel could not do what it does. Without $3.8 billion in weapons, Israel could not be bombing Gaza as it's doing. Without 501c3s that funnel money, tax-exempt dollars to militant settler groups, to other things in the occupied territories, none of this could be happening. So it's incumbent upon us as American citizens to try and affect our very fragmented and flawed political process in order to at least prevent the United States from contributing to exacerbating the problem, which is what we have done systematically over many decades as a country. The United States has made this problem worse. The United States is part of the problem. And we as citizens should be able to try and at least try and do something about that. So that would be my advice. We're not there. We can't change the situation in Jerusalem or in the occupied territories or in Israel. I think a lot of people, however, who have connections to Israel or Palestine or who are people of conscience should be able to affect both the discourse in this country and the political course of this country. It's not going to be easy. You know, the nature of politics in the United States is not responsive, especially on issues of foreign policy, to public opinion. Public opinion was against war in Iraq as of the fall of 2004, and the United States continued to fight in Iraq for many, many years after that. Public opinion turned against the war in Afghanistan. It's only this president who's finally said the United States is going to withdraw from Afghanistan. So public opinion directly cannot change things, but it can have an impact, and it has had an impact. It already is having an impact, I think. And I think the main things that we can do in the United States.
Well, I really want to thank you for that message, for your spending the amount of time that you did on an issue that I guess journalist John Pilger described many years ago is Palestine really is the question, and it is the answer to the conflagration that continues in so many ways in the Middle East and towards the issue of really a worldwide humanity taking up the cause and working towards the self-determination of the Palestinian people, free, free Palestine. Thank you so much for the time you've spent with us, Professor.
Well, thank you, Mimi.
Dr. Rashid Ismail Khalid, Director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and author of The 100 Years War on Palestine, a must read to educate, agitate, and organize for a free, free Palestine.
We have Omar Jaber from Al Auda. Let's welcome him. So now, let's get some poetry.
Sometimes I lose patience, lost in space in this sea of restless faces that amazes me. In 1948, millions of Jews relocate Palestinians by war, while political communities change colors like monthly comic book covers. But misplaced hate causes moral distaste, so I'm writing with rage as a way to keep pace, as a way to keep faith. because previous mistakes are hard to erase, so I find myself chasing my own imagination. And they call this negotiation. Say our methods are terrorists, that we target innocents, when the truth is, they do. The only difference is their blockades take longer. Starvation without representation, Israeli negotiation kills daily. And while they carry their wounded on stretchers and wheelchairs and take them to hospitals to receive quality health care, we cradle bleeding children miles before we find a paved road. Our ambulance is forced to swerve through dirt covered in bullet holes while Israeli negotiation kills daily. And while I do regret how Israeli civilians die, I can't forget women giving birth to dead infants on roadsides, dependent on teens with guns to let the doctors buy, while Israeli negotiation kills daily. So our children throw rocks, with or without slingshots, because no, we won't be tricked by their blankets infected with smallpox, because Israeli negotiation kills daily. So as peaceful handshakes are replaced by empty food plates, my hope for a better day fades, and I cling to house keys. And I cling to worthless words in the hopes that they might be heard beyond the mortal words of this media's standard absurdity. See, the fact is, we're cast aside, forgotten like so many other lost native tribes, and some say Jesus died for our sins, but when we die, we call it self-defense against the sins of a country hell-bent on building walls and fences. We die to defend our people's existence. We die, because after all, a great preacher named Martin Luther King once said, a man who won't die for something isn't fit to live. From the narrow alleyways of refugee camps to the massive valleys of our homeland, we will return. We will be free. Biruch, bidem, nefdikia Palestine. God bless Gaza and God bless Palestine.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges to the workers of the world. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.